welcome. Today with us, we have Revan and I'm Akash. Revan is the founder of Mosaic Wellness, a wellness and health platform. Revan is also a prolific angel investor. He's had a fascinating journey of having been switching over from the investing side to being an operator and a founder now, and is very well versed with the early stage. Today we are going to talk about what are some of the critical aspects of that seed stage, early stage, when founders are contemplating their journey. We'll also think through what founders can do about their approach to that stage, given the current market environment. But before we dive in, Revanth, would love to get a quick view of your journey so far, both at Mosaic and prior to Mosaic.
Sure. Thanks a lot for having me here, Akash. I've done one of these before, but I'll still give an intro because maybe the audience is different. And as I keep telling in my own marketing journey, you have to first introduce yourself to the audience as much as possible. So interesting journey for me, right? Before starting this, yes, I was a VC doing pre-seed, seed checks with K-Start. Before that, I was an operator with Rebel Foods for almost 6 years. And before that, I used to be in investment banking, actually helping startups raise capital much before it was sexy to start out, right? So in banking, I used to actually do more of growth fundraises. When I joined Rebel, I sort of helped raise the Series B, C, so let's call it the early growth post-PMF kind of fundraise. I used to invest in obviously pre-seed, seed, mostly pre-product, idea stage companies, and then obviously my own journey with entrepreneurship over the last two and a half years, right? So in some way, not only have I seen cycles over the last 12 years, I've also seen every aspect of every stage of fundraise for, you know, different kind of companies. So that's been a very interesting journey. And yeah, I think over the last 2 years, I think it's been fun building out a couple of health platforms that we have in terms of men's health and women's health. And hopefully, as we have just entered our third year of operations, we'll be able to get scalable PMF. And as everyone keeps asking, when's your next round of fundraise, hopefully that as well.
I'm not going to ask you that question, Revan, but I'm going to ask you something more specific. So when you started Mosaic after that great journey that you had across multiple cores, banking, operator, and then even K-Start, right? Sometime in 2020 when you started, what was your mental model when you were trying to think through taking that entrepreneurial plunge? And more importantly also, what was playing through your head in terms of thinking space, market? How do you start on this journey after having been an investor?
So I think it was relatively simple for me. I was very passionate about building B2C as a business. In spite of having known as an investor and an operator that capital efficiency in B2C businesses in India is super hard as such, right? But if I had thought from a VC mindset, I would not have built a B2C business, right? The reason I wanted to still do a B2C business because that's what I'm passionate about, right? Whether it's consumer psychology, whether it's the fact that we are a very hard, heterogeneous market where it's just hard and we are a low trust nation. Like everyone now knows this, there's enough gyan on Twitter on all of these things, right? But the challenge is something that I enjoy. Second, I had some sort of experience, or I would call it, I had done enough mistakes in trying to build out, let's call it brands with Rebel, right?
Yeah.
I had worked as an investor with B2C consumer internet companies and sort of help them in their journey as part of K-Start. And what I realized is that the more I understood the ecosystem, the better I could get at building something like that, right? So I was passionate. I think the skill set matched something. And the third aspect was, what are you thinking of, let's say, over the next 10, 15 years, if you have to build something, what would you be really keen to build out, right? And that's where the health and wellness space, I was 35, 36, so was my co-founder. Like today I've come in from a very deep health checkup. So it's just that age where you start realizing that we have not taken care of our health. And this is something that is neglected overall as a country, right? So passionate about space, passionate about thesis and segments where you want to build, some sort of expertise in terms of, you know, if you can think of a thesis or a go-to-market strategy, you know you have the skill set to build it out, right? Or you have the creds to sort of at least make sure that you're also able to raise venture capital. Because as two 35-year-olds, even my co-founder is actually from the venture background. Yes, we've done a lot of 0-to-1 things on our own in the first 18 months. But it would be great if you could have some amount of starting capital so that you could also build out a good team from day one, right? So like these were the potential considerations that we had. Each of them would be different. Like what is more scalable across different entrepreneurs? I think passion for the space is something that's important. Ability to, let's say the founding team's ability to crack open that model or the thesis, that's important. If you're 22, if you can bootstrap your way to an initial hypothesis, maybe you don't need to think about the venture backability of your business as well, right? But different stage founders, different segments would need different kind of hypotheses. I think what we did worked for us. We were able to raise a seed round right off the bat. And in the next 18 months, sort of also execute, show PMF, and then raise our subsequent Series A.
Got it. And Revan, those are the things we actually do want to spend time more time talking about. Talking about that venture backability, and I remember you raised a sizable seed round and the best of the investors backing you even in the earliest days possible. Given your experience, not just with your own raise, but also your experience as a seed investor earlier, what should be the considerations for founders? And you did mention and allude to being able to bootstrap the first 18 months, 500 days, how do you navigate those? But besides that, if you were to dig deeper, what should be the considerations for founders when they're thinking of their very first raise and if they're starting up?
So, as I said, in the end, if you really need capital to start out, then you need to start thinking about raising. Otherwise, I think raising should be the second consideration, right? Arriving at that one thing that you are really passionate about and what you think is a good white space where you would enjoy building, that is the first step. Now, let's say you've arrived at that. Let's say you've arrived at, okay, I want to build in fintech because I see this is a gap. Have you really tested out your hypothesis and, you know, done a few beta experiments to make sure that you're on the right path, right? I think a little bit of this equation changed in the last 18, 24 months where there was a lot of excitement about thinking about venture backing before you had actually even got passionate about the space, right? So if I go back to my days of seed investing with K-Start, most of the founders I would meet, and even most of the founders I meet today, are looking for their first check.
Yep.
Right? The only thing that I used to evaluate then and I still evaluate today is what I call founder market fit, right? Because every founder will have or every founding team would have a different sort of skill set. Not everybody is the same. Not everybody may be a storyteller. Not everybody may be a great digital marketeer or a great product person or may have a CTO from day one, right? But is the personality and the thought process around why you want to build for the space and some of the skill sets that you have in the founding team, are those aligned to the problem statement that you're looking to solve or not? And at a pre-product, pre-launch stage, that's it, right? What else do you have to go on? Now, yes, VCs do a bunch of market research, understand how large the market is and potentially how large a prospective business on that thesis could become. I mean, I'm not sure whether right or wrong, I didn't do a lot of that, even at KSR. And yes, maybe I didn't take a lot of bets that turned out to be large ones, but in the end, it's a fund that will return 6x, so I'm pretty sure that I didn't do a bad job there, right? So, and even as an angel, you know, I don't have an army of folks to sort of dissect the market and understand how large the market could be, right? As an angel, your job is to primarily help founders think through some of these aspects. And over a period of 10, 12 years now in this ecosystem, you have a broad sense of target markets, or at least in the end, the share of wallet on a B2C or a share of wallet on a yeah. B2B business is the same, right? In a sense that you would know that potential TAMs would be the kind of spends, household incomes, et cetera, right? So basic top-down analysis will help you there, but most critically, is the founder really, or is the founding team really passionate about the space? Do they have the right thesis to crack open the space? And do they have the right skill sets between them? Or even if they don't, have they identified those weaknesses and thought through about how they will solve them, right? That's about it. If you have thought about that as a founding team, not only are you able to actually raise capital, you'll actually be better at the business that you're trying to build out, right? The rest of the things will get solved over a period of time. We ourselves entered into a questionable TAM in terms of elective health and wellness, right? I keep telling people that there is roti, then there's kapda, then there's makan, and then there is health, and then there is elective health. Right? So when people have to start thinking about spending money, we come way back. So that itself sort of puts a TAM as a little bit of a question mark, right? But we are pretty confident that if you look at innate consumer psychology to improve their lives, they want to do that. And the problem statement is very simple, that is there something which is frictionless, enjoyable, something that is habit forming for them that will just help them improve their lives, right? And if you're able to crack that, then TAM refuses to be. And we've seen time and again examples of these. You can take a look at something like Urban Company, where for the last 8 years, every year I hear that the TAM is unclear. But today they are the largest salon in the country, for example, yeah, right? So some of these aspects get, if you are able to, in a B2C business or a B2B business, really understand the pain point of the consumer or the business that you're looking to serve, and your thesis is correct, I mean, the sky is the limit, right? So I really don't think a lot about the TAM aspects, but as a founder also, you should keep working a little bit more on really identifying the pain point and building a team around solving for that pain point.
Even obviously, as investors, obviously TAM becomes something which is super critical. And you mentioned this, right, that if you have a differentiated insight, you have a deep empathy and understanding of the problem statement, you're shaping a 10x value prop, that can still be outdone, right? But still going back to the same question, you've reached that point, you found that out, that you still do want to raise, you need to raise capital. You have all of this in place. How should founders go about putting together or building their roster of investors? Because investors are a critical part of the journey. They are almost your partners. They're not just passive backers. How should a founder approach building their investor pool?
I think it was much harder about 10 years back. Like I still remember for the Series B at Rebel, I met like 74 investors in a year. And I didn't know 74 investors existed back then, right? Like, you just keep figuring out from your Rolodex as to who else is there who can help you in this journey, right? Today, I think the market's much, much deeper. So I don't think it's a worry that, hey, are there enough investors or are there enough folks who would want to back this idea? I think the question today for most founders is, who's the right set of investors and what is the way I should approach this list of potential investors, right? I don't know if there is an exact strategy to this, but I think even the founder pool or the operator pool is now deep enough where everybody has had good enough experiences or not with different kind of investors, right? So you talk to five founders, they'll tell you who are the top three in their mind that, you know, somebody should approach. And even if there are differing names, eventually you'll end up with a list of 10, 15. That's your first set. Then you obviously ask the most relevant question, right? What if the top 10 don't want to back me? What the next 10 I should approach? And I think that still works in my view. Now, I don't really guide founders to prepare a list and then, you know, go after it one by one. I just think that's an insane waste of time for most of the founders, right? Because in the end, if you're not trying to, I mean, bankers can do that. That's their job. They're a sell side firm where people are supposed to be working that way, right? I think as founders, your time is very, very precious. And therefore, one thing that you should do is figure out a way to get a few angels on board who can quickly, like, why do you want to do one-to-one stuff when you can have one too many, right? If you have five angels on board, each one of them reaches out to five potential investors and puts in the right word to at least have a conversation, it just works. And and even if the investor doesn't think that this is the right team or this is not the right space, at least you'll get a yes or no directly through that connect itself. So I actually advise founders to maybe get on a quick pool of angels in the beginning, not worry too much about valuation. Once you get those angels on board, just ask them to quickly, because as a founder, at some point of time, 20-30% of your time will go into fundraising because you'll have enough stakeholders on day one. There'll be more stakeholders on day 10. There'll be even more on day 100, right? So more and more of your time will end up in that. In the beginning, 18-24 months, it's actually advisable to just focus as much as possible on getting your PMF right, right? So it's a little counter because a lot of founders tell me that, hey, but I may dilute a lot if I raise a 500K from angels at, let's say, only at a 5 million valuation, but potentially VCs will give me 15 million. I think everyone underestimates the amount of time it takes.
That's true.
And you end up just, and that, don't dilute 10%, dilute 2% to angels, but just get some people on board who can help you do stuff that you don't want to spend time on, right? See, building business, like I actually see this the reverse, right? A lot of people today approach me saying that, hey, I need help in marketing and therefore I want to speak to you once a month and why don't you come on the cap table? Yes, possible to do, understandable, right? But I fail to see the reverse approach where people say that, hey, if one founder can help me in marketing and one can help me in, let's say, technology and building out a tech team and stuff like that, your day zero problem is always going to be getting enough capital so that you can build out those teams, right? So your first approach to angels should always be that I want to figure out a way to short circuit my time. And I'm not saying that this is the job of angels, right? It's just that because they have been doing this for a while, they know the shortest possible route to get stuff done.
Basically, just put the fundraise behind you, get back to building. Great. And I think rather spending more time on, you mentioned product market fit and focusing on the right things. How do you discover or find product market? As a founder, when do you know that you've hit PMF? We do keep saying it's super critical in the early days for setting up a venture for success. If you were to look back at your days, the first 300 days at Mozaik and your journey to discovering and figuring out PMF, what advice would you have for founders today?
I myself, for the last 2 years, have kept asking this question to a lot of folks that how do you define PMF, right? How do you know when you have PMF?
Yeah.
And I've learned terms like early PMF, stable PMF, scalable PMF, right? I watch Matrix Movements where some of these terms were very clearly articulated. See, honestly, as a founder for the first 1 year, 2 year, you need to make sure that whatever paper hypothesis you had either is proven or disproven and you have moved on to a new hypothesis and you're looking to prove that, right? Let's call it a minimum viable product kind of situation. People sometimes get happy that, hey, I've built an app because and this hypothesis is there and let's say 1,000 users are using it, they are loving it. Cool, now go and get the next 10,000, right? And you'll discover 20 other problems. I think in a country like India, only when you hit for a B2C business, something like a million consumers served, will you really get to understand all the 20 sides of potential problems that you will face in your thesis. In a B2B business, because you have SMB, you have mid-market, you have enterprise, even if you're only enterprise focused, unless you get 5 clients, you're not going to discover every possible thing. And you're not just going to talk about signing 5 clients. It's not about signing the contract. Like I have seen a lot of young SaaS companies, after the signing, the go live takes like 9 months, yep. Right? So then you figure out what is the onboarding process. Onboarding ke liye achha, you need a separate person altogether, right? Then you need delivery, then you need customer success. Like, if you go through the full cycle for, like, let's say 5 enterprise clients, that will take you 18 months easy, right? So it's not about 12 months, 18 months, 24 months, but you have to get through the cycle where you are confident that, hey, I have understood all it takes to get 5 and complete 5 and keep those 5 happy. Now the next 20, I can now teach a team how to do it, right? So whether it's a B2B or B2C business, it's very hard to say when you have exact, let's say, stable PMF. But if it's a B2C business, people will say, okay, why don't you track NPS? Why don't you do the Sean Ellis test that if I disappear tomorrow, what's going to happen, right? So there are different ways to get an answer as to how sticky your product is, how loved your solution is for a platform. But it in my experience, it takes anywhere between a year to sometimes 3 years to get to that situation where you as a founder, like, okay, I am now in a state where I have done the 0 to 1 and maybe I can start giving a few, handing off a few things to the team, right? In that period, if you can avoid being distracted by 20 other things, that's the best that can happen, right? And tough, because not all founders will get funded for the first 18, 24 months. But yeah, I think that's what I also see sometimes taking time. Like, I think we were very lucky because we raised pre-launch. We had the luxury of not worrying about the next 36 months. And therefore, we could just relentlessly focus on execution and get to PMF within 12 months itself. I have seen in my journey with Rebel, for example, because we had to manage, okay, we have 18-month runway, we may need to fundraise, 20 different metrics may come about that investors may want to see. It sort of stops you from relentlessly pursuing the core PMF that you want. So I think it's a tough one. That's why everyone says, I mean, in fact, the data says that 90% mortality for seed stage startups, right?
Yeah.
Largely because those first 18, 24 months where the founder needs to be relentlessly focused on getting that PMF is something that they may not get, considering maybe they are bootstrapped, they're not capitalized enough, they've not been able to get in the right teams, etc. So advice, I mean, even in the last 18, 24 months, a lot of the founders that I had backed would usually come in and say that, hey, we are thinking about raising another round, what do you think? And my feedback to them would be, have you built what you wanted to build in the first 12 months? If the answer is no, then why are you even asking me this question?
Right? Even actually, just to dig deeper on that one, given that it's a good a year, year and a half journey many a times, be it B2B, B2C, does the first raise matter in terms of you having more shots at the goal because it is iterative? You could be testing your hypothesis multiple times, you could go wrong. Does that first raise become critical in that regard?
I think so. In fact, it's a little counter, again, where my advice to most founders is, if you're not getting the right size, if let's say you wanted 2 million to test out this hypothesis, and you're not getting that 2 million, don't take $500,000 and just say, I'll figure out 6 mahine ke baad dekhenge karke. Then clearly there is something incorrect, because if you thought you wanted 2 million and you're not getting it, then clearly either you have not got your thesis right, or the capital that you wanted to test out this hypothesis is too much and you need to figure out a more capital efficient way, right? Saying, okay, I'll take $500,000 and then figure out a more capital efficient way doesn't work, right? So if you can still go back and test your hypothesis, because then it becomes a harder spiral to climb, because once you take that $500,000, then you've undercapitalized, but you will not change your plans, because the comfort of money is, trust me, is a different thing, right? One, like, it was very hard for us, like, when we got our Series A term sheet, out of the 10 million seed round, we had only used 4 million. And the question was, why have you in over 20 months just used $4 million, right? There was a big question amongst teams also that we have raised this much money, so why are we not getting more people on board? I don't think getting more people on board or spending more money is going to get you your PMF sooner, right? And this was, I think, learning from hindsight, because like when I, in my third stint at Rebel, after I was CFO and then CMO, Behrooz happened because of survival bias, right? Because I had 2 crores and I had to figure out how to build a biryani brand in 2 crores over 6 months. Whereas I had actually burned $30 million to get Fasos to a sizable shape, right? But it happened because you had to figure out a way, right? And that's where the real value gets created. And that's what then everybody would enjoy, not just you, your team, investors, stakeholders, everyone, right? So sometimes it's okay to wait and go back and course correct versus just saying, okay, let me take what we can get, right? But yeah, I think if you are going to raise, make sure you raise for 24 months, right? Because anything less than that then is going to always be a problem for you.
Got it. And you went through this journey yourself in that 0-1 phase of starting during COVID or overlapping a lot with the COVID phase. 0-1 prior to that, earlier at Rebel, would have been very different. It was a very different environment. You were not remote. Now when you think of it, and obviously now we are getting back to normal, to a state where people are co-located and working together. Do you think for early stage founders, the remote or this hybrid work environment is a challenge? And does it render itself better in terms of your agility? Or you're able to hire across? You're not dependent or restricted to a single location? Or is the trade-off too much?
So I think, see, honestly, I think 1 to 10, 10 to 100 may actually work okay remotely. 0 to 1 is super hard. You're right, for us, the 0 to 1 phase, considering we started in May 2020, right? We just launched after the first lockdown. Super hard for us to do what we did. The benefit we had was, because I had done this before, we set out in a very structured form. We wrote down objectives every month. We wrote down what we want to achieve for those objectives, right? What are the success metrics? And just tried to be as precise as possible on the how. Like, let's say if you want to achieve an objective of scale with low CAC, how are we going to do it? And just focus on that. I don't think first-time founders will have that experience, because in the end, you are sometimes throwing darts, right? And you just need to iterate at a much faster level. I think it's going to be hard to do this remotely. Talent, I absolutely agree. I think product and tech also works great remotely. But it's a very, very structured thought. Even if you're in the 0 to 1 phase, your engineer is not going to hustle out something which is going to break, right?
True.
So while product and tech can be remote, I think business folks need to, if you need to iterate to PMF, I think it's super important that you are talking to each other as regularly as possible. And see, conversations also spark a lot of ideas. And structured conversations are not the way to get to the real creative ideas, right? You need unstructured, unfiltered conversations which just work well in person, in my view.
Got it. And, you know, Trevan, you have been an active supporter of early stage founders, backed many cores, and you've continued to do that. In the past few years, you also mentioned we saw multiple pre-PMF companies raise larger rounds. That luxury of capital was there. You could also raise follow-on rounds for your growth, even maybe just different types of PM that we spoke about. In today's world, when there is a lot of chatter, a lot of talk about a longish winter for venture activity, a lot of doom and gloom, do you think founders would have to rewire themselves and rethink and, you know, get prepared for facing a new reality? And if so, what could founders starting up today, who have been, let's say, looking at the past 3-4 years as a precedence, do about their own psychology and approach in these times?
So, honestly, I think founders are the most flexible in their thought process, because life for them changes. Like, I think, I forget the quote, but you have to zoom in at 10 feet, and sometimes you're looking at 10,000 feet, right? So, I think they get used to this, and changing funding environments is something that I think founders will adapt to pretty well. They will adopt it, and they will figure out their own ways, right? So, for sure, decision-making, your psychology will change basis how the market is evolving as well. I think it's a superpower of a business if your strategy doesn't need to change, or your thought process does not need to change as per the market cycles. Very few businesses like that exist, but yes, they do. And if you are building that kind of business, then you as a founder know that I don't need to change anything, because market cycles, you know, may change. Our business does not, because nothing in our business is so dependent on the market in that sense. Yes, you know, inflation may hurt consumer demand may reduce a little. Doesn't mean, okay, so instead of 3x, we'll do 2.5x this year. Doesn't change anything in our lives in a 10-15-year journey, right? So these sort of cycles happen. Very few businesses are actually built like that today, in my view, right? If founders can build such businesses from day zero, that's a great thing. But I think we are still a little nascent in our journey. Plus, overall, we are an overcapitalized nation with a lower demand than what, you know, most other countries would have, right? Their GDP to capital, VC capital in ratio would be much better than what we have as in our country. So yeah, most founders will end up sort of recalibrating a little bit. If you are a early stage founder, or you're thinking about starting out today, yes, for sure, you need to recalibrate a little bit of the euphoria that existed in the last 24 months, where if you are from any unicorn plus company at a VP plus level leaving today, and then 20 people will be jumping and saying, okay, let me fund you because, you know, yeah, you have a good idea, right? Today, you need a great idea. You need a good to, you know, much better thesis than what, you know, folks were getting funded at before. You would need to exhibit a very strong skill set. You know, the things that I mentioned in the beginning of the talk will just come back in vogue a little bit more stronger, right? I don't still think that it's bad for the ecosystem, because honestly, a lot of folks who are getting a little bit of FOMO that, hey, I'm earning a lot, but, you know, these founders are becoming richer by building unicorns in 2 years, I can also build, right? That's never the right reason to start out a company.
True.
We were seeing a lot of that in the last 2 years. In fact, I've met so many great operators who I keep saying that you should just continue what you're doing. Why do you want to start out, right? Because you have a great career. It'll even get better, right, sometimes. And some of them listened, some of them didn't, but that's fine. In my view, you should never start a business because you just feel that, hey, I'm wasting my life. Because I hear that a lot, that, yaar, 10 saal ho gaye, main kaam kar raha hu, I'm doing so well, but I think I can start my own company. Of course you can. But unless you really have a passion to grind it out for 10, 15 years, you should not do that, in my view, right? And it is a super hard journey. It's a super, super hard journey. In fact, a lot of people ask me that, hey, because my experience with Rebel was as an EIR, it was almost like an entrepreneurial experience. I even said, but you've done this before. You're almost like a second-time founder, right? I said, yeah, but I was 27 then. I'm 37 now, right? It's much harder to do when you're 37. Yes, a lot of the advantages are there.
Yeah.
But you need the energy levels that I see that in a 24-year-old today are amazing, right? It's hard for me to keep up with them. The kind of information assimilation that they do is tremendous. So I think you need to be very sure that you want to become a founder, you want to start a company, you want to build something which is unique, which will be sustainable, which will be long-term in nature, and something that you're passionate about. Because if you're not passionate about it, then you are not going to last the journey, right? And these cycles will come and go. Only passion takes you the full distance in that sense. So I think it's actually a good thing where we will go back to situations where founders will become founders because they really wanted to start something, versus it being a situation that, hey, there's a lot of money available, so this is the right time for me to start out now. And that's happened. We've seen that time and again when cycles, 2015 was similar, right?
The why now is basically the capital available.
Correct. That if your why now is capital available, then that's the worst reason to start out.
And before we part ways, Revant, one last thing, and you mentioned about this reason to start. When you think of your journey now in this 1 to 10, 1 to 100 pace, you would always have talent, which is entrepreneurial, and you would have talent who probably do not have a compelling reason to start. How do you carry forward an entrepreneurial culture now, right? When you're growing, you're constantly adding more people, you would be adding more senior leaders coming in. How do you create an environment where they're able to exercise the way at, let's say, Rebel, you had this EIR sort of a setup? How do you do that at Mozaq now?
So I've just continued what I did at, because what Jaydeep did at Rebel with getting the EIRs on board and really creating a lot of that business that we see today is what I have done from day one. So I hired my first EIR who set up the entire telehealth platform. Today he is a CXO in the company, managing, making sure that we do about 1 lakh doctor consults a month, right? And super hard problem to solve. Everything built ground up, right? Another EIR who joined me to set up Man Matters, our men's health platform, today leads the entire business, right? So today he owns a P&L of 100 crore plus in terms of revenues because he built that, right? I just posted on LinkedIn a couple of weeks back looking for an EIR for offline experience, because for me, if we are a digital health platform that is interconnected and wants to help create better habits, it's not about product sales and offline. We have to figure out a way to bring those individuals also into the fold, right? And I'm having a few conversations with folks. Again, same thought. If you can build out that business, and even if you fail, it's okay because you would have learned like an entrepreneur ground up, right? There was full independence to these EIRs. We've just actually started a fellowship program again where we are rotating young graduates into different functions, and then we are going to give them some project to sort of take and scale up. I would like to believe that the entire org is set up in a way where high ownership entrepreneurial thought process will get rewarded. We are in fact now in beta for a third health platform, which is being created by someone who led a large channel for us. He could have ended up owning or running 30-40% of the revenue for the business, but he wants to become an entrepreneur. So I said, "Theek hai, that's great. Why don't you do a 0-1 with me on the side on this?" Every year we do some 0-1, and I need now, my 0-1 itch also needs to get satiated, and but I can't do it all myself because I have a full company to manage, right? So I end up working with at least one or two folks on some 0-1 project at all points of time. And if they are able to crack it, I sort of let them run the entire P&L over a period of time. And that's something that we have not structured yet, but very soon we may actually have a very structured program where we may onboard an EIR, let's say every 6 months for something or other, right? Super important because, you know, I think Amrish had tweeted this, that there is no 1-10 in India. You're always in that 0-1 phase, however big you are, right? And it is true in my view, again, if you go back to what I said, lot of capital, lot of talent, low GDP per capita. The competitive environment is so strong that you need to figure out a way to continuously innovate, right? And that innovation cannot happen if you are a business that is just very, very structured and does not have that entrepreneurial talent coming in. So let's see. Hopefully, we'll be able to crack something. I think everybody should see something new coming from us next quarter. And once that hits, hopefully next year again. Like, I think the only way we could have built men's health in 2020 and then launched women's health in 21, while men's health was getting PMF, there was enough work going on the women's health platform as well, right? There was a lot of debate on, because, you know, if you go to most operators, they'll tell you that you first get core new PMF,
one, yep.
Then you go for the second one, right? The reason we built it the other way was because we knew that our thesis was that we would need multiple consumer segments. And my view is, I had seen the counter happen where Fasos was large, it was a 100 crore business. And when I wanted to build Berus, nobody wanted to work on it. Because why would someone want to work on something
on a
new?
Smaller, new.
I see that even today in our organization. I may have solved it with one EIR, like the third platform that we are building, there's an EIR and there's a small team, two people that they're working on it. But when they want company's resources, the company's resources are working on already something that is chugging along, right? They're like, hey, there's 200 crores of revenue happening here and I'm working on this. Yeah, I don't know why I should work on this aspect, right? How do you make sure that everybody in the company is aligned to innovation also?
And happening? Are you happy even if it's an 80-20 or it needs to be...
It's a tough... I still haven't found the answer yet, you know. In fact, I was debating this with the EIR yesterday night itself and he was like, we should align everybody's incentive such that it's 1/3 or, you know, something like that, right? Like, I remember when Be Body Wise, the women's health platform was being conceptualized and it hit and we were trying to get PMF. Nobody was working on it because there was just so much to do with Man Matters, right? I think both get solved if innovation still lies centrally. So I was assuring the EIR yesterday that don't worry. 0-1 is my responsibility as well. In the end, you have advantages of being a CEO and calling Vito, right? Ki, theek hai, all this is great. I just need this to be done, right? Just make sure this happens.
No, I think the EIR has an unfair advantage, at least at Mosaic.
Absolutely.
You enjoy doing 0-1 and they'll just keep rubbing off with the talent. Thanks, Rehwan. This was super insightful. Thanks, everyone, who joined us today. We'll see you soon next time.
Thanks for tuning in. For more Matrix Moments episodes, you can head to www.matrixpartners.in/matrixmoments. You can also follow us on Twitter, LinkedIn, and YouTube for more updates.